Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Albert Morales, and this morning's conversation is with Air Force Surgeon General, Lieutenant General George Peach Taylor. Also joining us in our conversation is Michael Perry. General, we've talked a little bit about the infrastructure as well as the strategic changes in how you treat soldiers and transport them. How is this going to impact the future of military trauma medicine?
The most important thing that we've discovered is the ability to stabilize those that are injured as far forward as possible. In order to do that, all of the services have created forward surgical capability that we place very far forward and almost in contact with the troops that allow us to give the basic airway support, hemodynamically stabilize them, give them blood or fluids to support their blood pressure and stabilize their fractures, and then move them quickly from the battlefield. And this requires small, highly talented teams. The Air Force's version of this is called a mobile field surgical team. It consists of five people: ER doc, orthopedist, general surgeon, anesthesiologist or CRNA, and a respiratory therapist. And they can operate out of backpacks and go any place, even a room the size of the room we're talking in now, and do four major resuscitative procedures. The Army has a similar version. The Navy has a similar version that you may have talked about. And that links into having small mobile hospitals that are highly capable, like the one in Balad, that can go very far forward. The Air Force's 25-bed version of that can deploy in two C-17s and be set up in 24 hours or so. In fact, for Operation Enduring Freedom, we took a 25-bed hospital from the Air Force Academy, called them on Friday, and Sunday or Monday they were seeing patients downrange. And so it's the ability to push people way forward that's important. How do we keep these people trained is another important aspect, because most of the hospitals that we operate in the DoD are not in the business of major trauma care. The most prominent one that we do is in San Antonio, where the Army and the Air Force are in the trauma center there, system center there, and they do some of that in the National Capital Region as well. What we do in the Air Force is we have a very strong partnership with Baltimore Shock Trauma Hospital, where we have a team of docs and we rotate our surgeons and our anesthesiologists through the shock trauma center, and they operate and they run the trauma teams along with the civilians to get exposure to taking care of very, very sick, very complicated, very sick patients. After they do a resuscitation and take care of a patient, then they go back and say, well, if this patient had arrived and I was a mobile field surgical team in XYZ country, what would I do? We're also doing the same thing with the critical care transport teams with a partnership at the University of Cincinnati. So we're teaming in a large number of areas, and one of the things we're very interested in the three areas where we do this, we do it at Shock Trauma in Baltimore, we do it at the University of Cincinnati, and we do it at St. Louis, is partnering them in research in these areas that link what's happening in the civilian world with the military world, and there are very many common approaches and common questions that we have among us. So this is really military trauma medicine is increasingly exciting, and every time we have this kind of level of conflict, we learn more than we ever knew.
General, given the management changes already underway within the Air Force, what are other changes you're planning for the coming 3 to 5 years?
Al, I think you'll see the continued evolution of the partnerships that we have between the three services. We talked earlier about operating increasingly joint. The new Walter Reed National Military Medical Center that's being built at Bethesda will be staffed by Army, Navy, and Air Force personnel. I think you'll also see an increasing partnership between the Veterans Administration and the military services, and you'll also see increased partnership with the civilian sector. An example for the Air Force is we are not going to build a new hospital at MacDill Air Force Base down near Tampa. Instead, we're going to build a professional office building, and our surgeons and orthopedists are going to be working in Tampa General Hospital downtown. That allows our providers to practice the full span of their health care in a large platform. And so you'll see increasing partnerships, and you'll see continued increase in partnerships for training opportunities, but you'll see in the delivery of care partnerships between the Veterans Administration, not only in healthcare records, but in the provision of services. The other huge management changes you're going to see is an increasing pressure on our military medical system to be performance-based. We have to submit a business plan that specifies how much work we're going to do, and increasingly we're going to be resourced not based on past historical trends but on the work we believe we're going to contribute to the system. So building a prospective payment system and building a performance-based operation is actually a bit of hard work for us, because we're regulated, our inputs are regulated, and yet we're going to be measured on a universal output. So we can talk more about that if you wish, but probably the two biggest changes are going to be increased partnerships and changing the way we actually finance the system.
General Taylor, you recently described retention efforts as being the oxygen of the Air Force Medical Service. What steps are you taking to strengthen retention and career development?
The Air Force has always been a retention service. Interesting anecdotes I like to say is that the Air Force has never drafted anyone except doctors, except physicians in the old Berry plan. The Air Force, it takes a while to develop a medic, whether it's a radiology tech or an orthopedist. And very clearly from my perspective, if we could retain more of those people rather than try to train them in the pipeline, that'll give us an increased depth and an ease of operation. I think we've been working very hard on pay to make sure that we have a roughly equivalent pay system. We'll never be able to pay the same rates in some specialties as in the civilian world. So that leads me to the second part, which is the quality of practice. And so it's very important to me that the people that are practicing in the Air Force, operating from a first-rate facility with first-rate equipment and with the least constraints on their practices possible. And that's why you're seeing us increasingly asking our providers to work in a civilian hospital, because our hospital is too small or doesn't have the depth to provide the full capability of that person's practice. And so you'll find general surgeons doing their complicated cases in a civilian hospital that allows them to practice full range of their skills and yet still be able to be in the Air Force and be deployable. It's very difficult work, but it's very rewarding work. One small anecdote. One of the advantages of deploying medics frequently is they get exposed to the what you could call the real mission of the Air Force, which is providing health care anywhere. When I was in Manas, Kyrgyzstan, I talked to an internist, the only internist in Kyrgyzstan, Air Force internist in Kyrgyzstan, and his responsibility was to take care of the 1,000 or so military folks that were at the airbase there. In his regular life, he was a bone marrow transplant physician in San Antonio. And he said, you know, I was sort of thinking of getting out because I can do bone marrow transplant, you know, anywhere in the country and make a wonderful living. But if I could actually get to deploy every 4 months of every 20 to a place like this, put my basic internal medicine skills to work in a remote location, what a wonderful life that is, compared to being a hemoc doc in a city. So it's one of the advantages, and I think most of the physicians will tell you, and most of the medics and the nurses and the dentists will tell you, that when they come back, it's been an extraordinary experience for them, and it tightens their connection with the service. And I think that's an important thing that we're trying to build on in terms of retaining people and putting them on a career path that is one that's very rewarding for their time in the service.
It's a wonderful story and anecdote. General, you've had a very distinguished career. What advice would you give to a person who's considering a career either in the military or in the healthcare business?
I think for any person entering in any career, whether it's government or the private sector, the most important thing you do is you bring certain competencies and capabilities to the operation. And what you want to do is you want to do the best in any little task that you have or any big task that you have. If you do very well in the small tasks that you're given when you enter, when you're a young person, you're 21, 22, 23, 24, and enter into public service or private service, you will be given a task. Your job is to do the task to the best of your ability, and little tasks lead to bigger tasks. Particularly in the public sector, can speak frankly for the Air Force. The Air Force does a very good job of identifying those people who are very capable and are very talented and pull them along in the system, giving them more responsibility and a broader scope of practice. And so if you're just starting out in the public service, you don't need to start out with a big job, I guess I would have to say. You start out with a small job and do it marvelously. I started out as a flight surgeon for a squadron. I had about 50 pilots and their family members to take care of, and I wanted to make this, you know, the most fantastic squadron I could, and I wanted to be the best flight surgeon I could for these folks, not for the Air Force or anything. I wanted to be the best for them, and I was rewarded for that as I went along in growth. So for people first starting out, it's not the size of the job that matters. It's what you can do in that job to make a difference.
That's excellent advice. General, we've reached the end of our time, and that ought to be our last question. I want to thank you for fitting us into your busy schedule today. But more importantly, Michael and I would like to thank you for your dedicated service to our country and to the medical profession.
Well, thank you, Alan. Thank you, Mike. If you'd like more information, we do have a website that contains many of the stories that I told and some more pictures. And it's the website is airforcemedicine.afms.mil.
Great. This has been the Business of Government Hour, featuring a conversation with Lieutenant General George Peach Taylor, Jr., Surgeon General of the United States Air Force. Be sure to visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's conversation. Once again, that's businessofgovernment.org. As you enjoy the rest of your day, please take time to remember the men and women of our armed and civil services abroad who can't hear this morning's show on how we're improving their government, but who deserve our unconditional respect and support. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Albert Morales. Thank you for listening.